We are slowly working our way through Matthew chapter 15. I've mentioned in previous class times that I'm glad things are as they are, that we moved much more quickly through the events of Jesus' life as recorded by Mark. And now we're at the point where we have several weeks left and only about two chapters to cover, so we've been able to kind of slow down and think about the gravity of the situation that we read about in those two chapters related to Jesus' trial, his death, and now his burial, as we start in chapter 15 of the Gospel of Mark in verse 40. And so we're gonna talk about just a couple of things related to that, and we're going to read from the text, and then I'll do some explaining and give you an opportunity, if you wish, to share some of the observations that you make from this chapter. We're going to start in verse 40, as the slide says. Remember, this is following the events that Mark records about the death of Jesus, some of the things that he says while he is on the cross, and some of the people that he interacts with there. And that section concludes in verse 39 as kind of a summary statement. The centurion who had been observing all of these events and had seen many people executed in this way had noted that there was something different about Jesus and exclaims, "Truly this man was Son of God." I don't think there's any way in the world that this centurion could have understood that Jesus Christ was the Son of God. And the language that's used there does not contain the word "the" in the original language. But he is saying this person's different. This is unlike any crucifixion scene that he had ever experienced. And so in verse 40, Mark shifts gears, and he just basically, you can almost, of course, Mark would not have been there, but if we understand things correctly, it's likely that Peter is the primary informant for Mark's gospel. Remember that Peter is friends of Mark's family, and so it's likely that Peter, who was an eyewitness, in this case from a distance, would have been able to share some of that kind of thing. You can almost see in Mark's record here, beginning in verse 40, Peter surveying the scene, and he looks around at the faithful from the eyes of somebody who at that moment is unfaithful, somebody who has fled. He looks around, and as Mark records it, there were also women looking on from a distance, among whom were Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James the younger, and of Joseph, and Salome. And when he was in Galilee, they'd followed him and ministered to him. And there are also many other women who came up with him to Jerusalem. I find this to be a curious observation in a way. Not wrong or bad, obviously, but just kind of unusual. Remember what we've said all along is that the compact nature of Mark's gospel means that he has to make choices about what he includes and what he leaves out, and there's a lot of things left out. And so for him to take this block right here and just talk about the fact that all these women were at the scene of the crucifixion and that they had been faithful all the way from the time of his Galilean ministry is interesting to me. Now, there's a list of women that Mark includes. I'm going to go ahead and put these up here. And you notice that I've got, in addition to the text from Mark chapter 15, also John chapter 19 and verse 25 and Matthew 27 verse 56. The lists harmonize, and I've told you before, I'm not doing a lot of harmonizing of the Gospels in this. I'm kind of trying to let Mark speak with his own voice, and I'm following that here as well, but there is consistency here, but the naming is a little bit different. And so just for a moment, let's consider who's here. Mary was a really popular name, okay, for women. Three of the four people here are named Mary. There is Mary, the mother of Jesus. Well, three of the five people, I guess, mentioned. Some confusion about this. Mary, the mother of Jesus, and her sister. In some of the accounts, it says Mary and her sister and Mary, wife of Clopas. It almost sounds like that Mary, the wife of Clopas, and Mary's sister could be the same person. The problem with that, if it is a problem, is that you got two girls in the same family, both named Mary, which, unless you're like George Foreman, People normally don't name their kids the same name. For those of you who are unfamiliar with that, you can ask me about it later. But so probably that represents another person, but we're not given her name. That is Mary's, Mary, the mother of Jesus' sister, who also was there. Then we have Mary Magdalene, and one of the accounts adds the one out of whom the demons were cast. And so we know her. We know she has been faithful, shows up a lot of times, even at times when there's no emphasis on women being present. She's just always there, it seems like. She's obviously a very dedicated follower of Jesus throughout his ministry from the time of her exorcism and up to this time. She's visible. Then we've got Mary, the wife, Mary, the mother of James and Joseph. The way this looks in the original language is Mary, the mother of Jacob and Joseph. Now Jesus has brothers with these two names as well, but there does seem to be sufficient distinction to say that this is not, this is another person besides Mary, the mother of Jesus. There is a reference in another of the accounts to Mary, the wife of Clopas, and you notice in parentheses I have put her in this spot because I think that properly harmonizes. She could be the wife of Clopas and the mother of James and Joseph. And likely the difference is who does maybe the writer of the gospel think the readers of the gospel know best? Are they more likely to know the father? Are they more likely to know the children? Remember, all of this is being written down years, as much as 20 to 30 years after the events took place. So by this time, it may be that the children are better known to a certain audience than the father was. Matthew perhaps is maybe more likely to mention the father because of the patriarchal emphasis among Judaism, whereas perhaps Mark might be more likely to mention the children, especially if those kids have turned out to be church leaders and would become better known to some members of the audience. Just some speculation there. And then there is the one not named Mary. Boy, must she have been embarrassed. Salome. In another of the accounts, she is not mentioned by name, but the designation is made that there is a woman there who is the mother of the sons of Zebedee. So this would be Mrs. Zebedee, Salome, perhaps, if this is the same person. Now again, first of all, it doesn't matter in one sense exactly who's who here. And second of all, I concede that there is some speculation here, but that's the way that I'm kind of harmonizing the list of women who are present here. You can see the connections. These are people, in that sense, people we've heard about before, if all of this is right, with the possible exception of Mary, the mother of James and Joseph. All right, so these are women who are present there. Before I go on any further, does anybody have any question or observation, or would you like to correct me? You knucklehead, that can't be right, because I'm willing to acknowledge the fact that I may have gotten that wrong. All right, but the bigger question is, why is this here? I made mention of the fact that with the economy of Mark's gospel, it's kind of interesting that he takes, you know, every bit of space is significant. So why is this section here? Well, I'll make a few observations here, and then I'll invite you to do the same if you like. First of all, perhaps it is notable that the people who are left here are women, that pretty much all of the male disciples of Jesus, including the apostles, have all disappeared at this point. Now, obviously, they're not so far away that there's not witness to all this, but they are making themselves scarce. Peter's denial, the fact that he was marginal even before the denial and then just overtly rejects any association with Jesus, that's more clearly stated, but the others are gone too. John is obviously apparently close enough by that Jesus is able to see him and entrust his mother's care to him, so he's not quite as far away, but we understand the fear that they must, the fear and confusion, we've alluded to this before, that they're experiencing when this one they thought would always win appears to be losing, and they do not necessarily covet the prospect of what's happening to him also happening to them. These are human beings. Is there any reason why the females would be more likely to still be here than the males, though? Well, without, again, engaging in a certain amount of speculation, in a position where all of the leaders would be expected to be men, they would be more threatened than would be the women. There would be some expectation that the women would be benign in terms of their influence, if there's going to be any kind of an insurrection or a rebellion that takes place there. You'd not expect women in that culture to conduct that sort of thing. So maybe they might have felt a little bit safer, or maybe they're just better people. That's not unheard of, is it? For the women to be better people than men in certain circumstances. This is mentioned as a setup for what happens in verse 42 and following. If this is a prelude then to the story of Joseph of Arimathea coming and requesting the body of Jesus. The women are here, but likely would not have been in a position to have gone and asked for the body of Jesus. It's hard even to talk about this sometimes because it sounds so demeaning to women. And it is. In that culture, however, women did not have much voice, did not have much right, and would have been unlikely to get the attention of the leaders of the Romans to be able to procure Jesus' body. Now, the truth of the matter is, one of the things I'm going to say in a few minutes, and I'm going to say it now, I don't know why I'm doing that, is that not just anybody could have come, even among the men, and have gotten the body of Jesus. And that's one of the reasons why Joseph of Arimathea is a significant figure in this conversation. But maybe this short paragraph, as it's distinguished in the Bible that I'm using today at least, is there to set up the events of verses 42 and following. Maybe I've got a heading injected there. Maybe that heading ought to be before this whole section, because this kind of reads through. Here's the situation. There are a bunch of women here. Here's who they were. They've been followers for a long time. And if you'll allow me to insert this little word, but, there. But they're not going to be in the position to do what comes next. So, another word I'll inject. So, Joseph of Arimathea shows up to some degree to kind of solve a problem that we've begun to recognize. All of the disciples that are there are women. And so therefore, somebody needs to step up and be able to do what needs to happen next. And they would not perhaps have been in the position to do it. So that's the way that I take this short section, this short paragraph, a couple of verses, highlighting the faithfulness of these women and their presence on that scene. Other comments before we move forward with Joseph? Larry. Right. Status. They could divorce, they could have a business, they could do anything. Do you think that this was injected about women for the primary reader in any way? Yeah, if you couldn't hear Larry was mentioning the fact that Mark wrote right primarily to the Romans, as we've talked about before, and that women had a bit more status in the Roman world than they did in the Jewish world. Now, there's nothing about the Hebrew scriptures that demeaned women in any way, but it was a strongly patriarchal society. The Roman society was a bit less so. And we see this in a variety of places. You think about what we see as we move through the book of Acts and we get outside of Judea, we begin to see people like Lydia show up, obviously a person of prominence in the society, and a number of other leading women that we see being referenced there. And so Larry asks, does Mark insert this perhaps to acknowledge the significance of these women to a culture that would have perhaps appreciated that bit more? Is that a fair summary, Larry? And so, of course, none of us can peek inside the head of the writer, but given who Mark's primary audience appears to be, that's certainly a reasonable thing to consider. That it would certainly at least have had that effect as a Roman audience reads this, and perhaps even today as we appreciate the significant spiritual devotion of women who've been significant influencers in our own lives. All right, good. Frank?
I've kind of looked at this a little bit differently.
Why does that not surprise me?
I ask what something is there for, and I think that if we went back in Mark chapter 10, and we talked about who was it that was concerned about, who was it that was concerned about the children, or Matthew 19, it's the same, the women, I think this is here to elevate the importance and the commitment the women made in Christianity or in our lives.
Mm-hmm. Hope you could hear what Frank said. No, well, I hope you can hear what he said. I'm just again to highlight. Frank says that it may well be that this is included to elevate the significance of women in their spiritual faithfulness in the kingdom, and to highlight that, Frank. In addition to what you said, you know, most of us who have tried ever to plant a church or do mission work in other places have seen that women tend to be much more receptive more quickly than men, and small churches outside the Bible Belt, at least, are populated much more heavily by spiritually minded women than they are men. Necessarily men and women are better than men, but they tend to be more willing to consider in their heart things that are powerfully significant sometimes. And so that apparently that's not a new phenomenon. It's happening here as well. All right. Well, just another reference to the timing of all this. Remember that this is Friday, and all of these events have taken place really up until now through the night, what we would call Thursday night into Friday morning early, when the Romans wake up. They've got this case before them. There's this business with Pilate, ultimately leading to Pilate sentencing him such that he is crucified about the third hour of the day, or 9 a.m. Jesus has been on the cross for 3 hours when it gets dark, and it stays dark for 3 hours. Then there are the rapid succession of events that take place after the lights come back on. Jesus has a couple more things to say, then he breathes his last, which brings us to about 3 p.m. It is significant for us to think about the timing here. This is called the day of preparation. That means that this is the day before the Sabbath of the Passover. Okay, so this is the day you would have spent getting ready for the Passover, because once the Passover starts, not only is there a ceasing of normal weekly activity, but also because it's a Passover, a very specific set of things that are expected to be done during this period of time. And that sounds like, well, you know, it's a busy time to get all that stuff done, and then, you know, tomorrow we're not going to be able to do the regular things. Well, remember, tomorrow starts at sunset for the Jews. So everything that's going to happen the end of which is they're back snuggled back in their homes. That's all got to conclude by about 6 p.m. So from the time that Jesus breathes his last, about 3, until the time when everybody has got to be back in their houses at 6, you got 3 hours there to accomplish whatever needs to be accomplished. That means if they wish to give Jesus a proper burial, it's going to have to be done in that three hours. And what's got to happen? Think about it. Well, after Jesus dies, there has to be a recognition of that death, such that the soldiers know they've done their job. There has to be the request for the body of Jesus. The body has to be taken, prepared in some way for the grave, placed in the grave, and people back home in 3 hours. So all that's kind of where we are. So the Sabbath begins at sunset, in this case the Sabbath of the Passover. All Jewish people have got to be home and ready to observe that significant occasion. So at this point, Joseph of Arimathea, a man that we've not yet met in the Gospels, steps forward. When evening had come, since it was the day of preparation, that is, the day before the Sabbath, Joseph of Arimathea, a respected member of the council, who was also himself looking for the kingdom of God, took courage and went to Pilate and asked for the body of Jesus. Pilate was surprised to hear that he should already have died. And summoning the centurion, he asked him whether he was already dead. And when he learned from the centurion that he was dead, he granted the corpse to Joseph. And Joseph bought a linen shroud, and taking him down, wrapped him in the linen shroud and laid him in a tomb that had been cut out of the rock. And he rolled a stone against the entrance of the tomb. Mary Magdalene and Mary, the mother of Joseph, saw where he was laid. Okay, so let's think about this. What we know about Joseph of Arimathea is almost entirely found in this one set of verses, these couple of verses here. Two or three things that we can know from that. First of all, Joseph is identified here as a respected member of the council. What's the council? I'm hearing. This is not helpful. Okay, this is a likely reference to the Sanhedrin. This is a council of the Jews. Joseph is Jewish. He is a respected member of the council. So he's got that. John mentions that he up to this point had been a disciple secretly out of fear of the Jews. In other words, he's a guy who stands in a position to lose a lot by becoming a disciple of Jesus. Now, unlike all of us who would be so brave that we would have been very explicit and just told everybody, he's being a little tentative about this. But think about it. I love the way Mark describes this. He's been looking for the kingdom of God. So he is a person who is, first of all, and there's a sense in which every Jew could have been described that way, right? I mean, all of them are waiting for the Messiah, especially during those times when they are a captive people, which they are now, with their autonomy limited and frustration and bitterness about the occupation that they're experiencing. So everybody would be like that, but there is implicit in Mark's description of him that he has gone beyond just this sort of passive hope or wish and is pursuing allegiance to Jesus as probably a recognition that that's happening here. What's interesting about that is that for many people, what's just happened to Jesus would have been failure of the litmus test. If you're trying to identify the guy who's going to bring the kingdom in, and that guy just got killed, no more kingdom. That's the way that even apparently many of the disciples, closest disciples of Jesus, even his apostles, are kind of thinking about that at this point. No, I guess not. But Joseph doesn't do that, obviously. Or I say obviously, it seems obvious to me. I guess you could argue that he's just doing this as a courtesy, but it appears that he is a true believer, but he has kept it secret. Now, I think we maybe can give him a little grace here for being a secret disciple as he's kind of trying to sort all this out. You think about the language that is used a couple of times for Mary early in Jesus' life. She treasured these things up in her heart, or she was kind of sorting these things out. I think what you see is that a number of other people are doing the same thing, particularly those who have a lot of reasons to be very careful about accepting all of this. If Nicodemus expresses his belief too early, and it turns out Jesus is not who he claims to be, he has lost his place on the council, his whole life changes. And so John just simply says he formerly was secret, a disciple in secret because of the Jews. However, clearly, he steps up on this occasion. Further, and related to the first of the second level bullets on this slide, he is a significant person such that he apparently has access to the Roman procurator Pilate. Not everybody would have been able to come in and make this request. That's connected also to what we talked about on the previous slide, something these women likely would not have been able to do. Joseph is in a position to do, not just because he's a man, but because he is a respected member of the council. So he goes as a person who apparently possesses some standing in society, not just among the Jews, but his reputation is such that he could go and make a request for the body of Jesus. And it's as soon as Pilate finds out that Jesus has indeed died, it appears to be an easy request to grant. At this point, Joseph moves from the shadows of discipleship to the forefront. He clearly identifies himself with the followers of Jesus. So he does at that moment something that the other disciples are unwilling to do. This is the whole point of their running away, is that, or at least I believe it is, that if they continue to show themselves to be connected to Jesus, they become targets of persecution themselves, possibly even execution. Joseph is willing to run that risk. Now, Mark doesn't, but John also mentions that Nicodemus was with him, which makes, I believe, two members of the Sanhedrin. We meet Nicodemus back in John chapter 3, and he is also a leader of the Jews, it says. And so here you got these two guys who perhaps have been very quietly working behind the scenes to know and have come to believe in Jesus. And at this point, you've heard me say before is that at this point, as the public disciples of Jesus shrink back, the private disciples of Jesus step up or step forward and make themselves known at this point. What's interesting about it is we don't get a lot of information about them following this. This is their moment. We meet Nicodemus in John 3. We see the two of them pictured here. Whether they become leaders in the church or anything like that, we don't have any information about that. But at a moment when they're needed most to acknowledge their devotion to Jesus, they're willing to do that when others aren't. Observations about this, some of your commentary, which I'm sure would be very encouraging and enlightening. Frank? That's true. Yeah, the only people that I think that would have had an interest in that would have been his disciples, because the rest of them had already disowned him, the rest of the Jews. So Joseph and Nicodemus come as believers, and they are able to do or willing to do what other believers were not willing to do, and that is to identify with Jesus in that way. I think they would have cared and been disturbed by it, but were not willing to do anything about it. Those who were unbelievers would have been happy to see his body hang there and get picked off by the birds. We'll talk more about this later. But this crucifixion is normally something that goes on for days, not hours. Other observations? Yes, Ben?
Was this another part of the prophecy that had to do with what happened to Jesus?
Yeah. Well, among the Jews, the culture would have been that the body would have been taken down, given a proper preparation, and placed in a tomb. That would have been the thing to do. Jesus is awfully young to have had a tomb prepared at that point. Anyway, what would have been done had Joseph not stepped up is hard to say. But this was the socially acceptable thing to do. Further, there are a couple of prophetic references to the fact that he is taken and laid in a tomb or in a borrowed tomb or whatever, or assumed it was not his own. So yes, this is another part of fulfilled prophecy. Okay. Well, kind of coming back to where we are when Joseph requests that Jesus' body be given to him, and Pilate says, shouldn't we wait till he dies? I mean, I don't mean to be funny about that, but he's very surprised because, as I've indicated, crucifixion normally takes a long time. So he calls for the centurion who has been commissioned with this task, and he just says, you know, has he died? And he has died. And so he's a little surprised by this, but once there's this confirmation, he's okay with it. Other of the gospel writers include an awful lot more of what happens at this moment or the moments preceding it than Mark does, that they go along and they break the legs, request the legs be broken on those who are on the cross to speed up the death process, okay? And I find that this is a very distasteful discussion all around anyway, but you are aware that crucifixion is death by crucifixion is a result of asphyxiation or suffocation. You can't breathe anymore because you've lost the strength in your legs. You can't push up to engage the diaphragm so that you can take another breath. That normally takes, with a good, healthy person, a long time before they become that weak where they can't do that. And so if you want to get people down off the cross so that the events that you have started can come to conclusion, you can get back home before the Passover starts. The way you do that is to break the legs where they can't push up at all, and they'll die of suffocation much more quickly. And so that's what they go to do. They do that to the other two, the robbers that are on the crosses next to Jesus. But when they come to Jesus, find that he's already dead, they simply pierce his side with a spear. Out from that flows blood mixed with water. Clearly, at that point, he is dead, and that's kind of where Mark takes back up with this account. They come, the centurion has ensured that Jesus was indeed killed by the crucifixion, and therefore his body is available. My expectation is at this point that all the bodies would be available, and Joseph is the one who speaks up for Jesus' body. Whether or not anybody spoke up for the other two, we don't know. And some of that messy business, Ben, that you ask about related to, you know, how... Or, and Frank asked, why do they care about this? Well, the Jews have enacted a process that they need, that they want to get concluded, especially with Jesus. They need to see he dies because they don't want to take any chances that he'd still be alive, and all that needs to take place and get them back before the Sabbath begins in the evening. So Joseph takes the body to a tomb, the Bible says, which is cut out of a rock. Now, this would have been common among the Jews, especially in the area of Jerusalem. My parents-in-law lived on a place that they affectionately called Rocky Top, and we went out one time to bury a dog out there on the hill, and there was no question why it was called that. It was hard. I wanted to put this little... I needed a hole about that big. I think it took me about an hour and a half to dig that hole because of all the rocks. Well, this is the terrain that you see in Jerusalem. Most burials probably did not take place underground. There's just an awful lot of rock around, and so this was a tomb that was cut out of a rock. Further, there is not time, and we're gonna show a couple of pictures here in a couple of minutes. There's not time for the traditional burial process. Now, the Jews aren't like the Egyptians. They don't embalm and go through all that elaborate thing to preserve the body forever, but there is a process through which they go, and we know that did not put off the decay very long. You'll remember in John chapter 11 when Jesus says to open up the tomb of Lazarus, they said, it's been 4 days, he stinks. You know, so that's, but there is a process through which they go in order to prepare the body so that they can interact with it during the funeral process and things like that. Well, they didn't have time for that. Instead, the Bible tells us that Joseph arranged to have the body wrapped in a linen shroud. Okay. Now, perhaps you've heard about the Shroud of Turin. Okay, so named because the shroud is housed in a place in northern Italy called Turin. And that's where the thing gets its name. It was discovered many, many centuries, thank you, many, many centuries after the death of Jesus. Somebody got the idea that this was the shroud in which Jesus' body was embalmed. Now, let me help you a little bit with this, if I can. Right here, you can see on the bottom, this is the entire shroud. It's quite long, like 10 feet long. But down on the bottom is this image. You can see it, head, chest, and arms crossed in front of him, legs going down. And so they've said, well, this is a burial shroud, and there is a negative image burned into this shroud. And there's been all kinds of research done on this, and it's just a lot of stuff that's outrageous, and I'm not a believer that this is the burial shroud of Jesus or anything like that, but it gives you some idea of why that has become an issue. And you can see over here on the right, this is a part of the same thing. It's taken that negative image and it has reversed it to make it a positive image. Say this is what that would have looked like. And there, this has been enhanced somewhat. There was a restoration of this thing done about 35 to 40 years ago so that you could see better. You can see it's kind of difficult to get much detail out of this. The more work that was done to it, the better the image can be seen, even some of the features of the face and the hair and all that, which is kind of strange because, you know, if a person's gone through what Jesus does and his body's put in it, his hair is probably not going to have much body to it. And yet there's image of the hair. It's all very, very interesting. Here's some of the detail. Now, on the right side of the screen, you see kind of what you could actually see there, and on the left side of the screen is an enhanced version of that. Okay, I show all that to you just for your curiosity's sake, just in case anybody's wondering about the Shroud of Turin and what this shroud would have been like. Likely this would be the kind of thing that a person would have lain on it, and then it would have been folded over and tucked in around him. Either this version that we looked at previously, the person would have been laid on it, and then the thing would have been wrapped, would have been laid back over him vertically as we're looking at it right now. Likely, it depends on how wide the fabric was, how big their loom was when they made it, is whether or not they would have done it like that. If it was wider, they probably would have just wrapped it over horizontally, as I would call it. At any rate, this was preserved. And by the way, some of the stuff that looks like decorative elements probably wasn't. Probably this is just places where the thing got tucked in, and therefore it aged at a different pace and things like that. All right, so all we know is that the body of Jesus was put in this shroud and laid there very hurriedly, is the idea that you're supposed to get from this. Not that there was some kind of an elaborate ritual, but actually quite the opposite. That the body of Jesus was just quickly laid in the tomb, and that, of course, comes to the fore as we think about the events that happened early Sunday morning. They didn't finish the job, so they rush back. It would have been about 18 hours after the burial of Jesus. They rushed back to try to finish the anointing of the body. None of that apparently was done at this point. Matthew then says that the body of Jesus was laid in Joseph's own tomb, and that it was a new tomb, previously uninhabited. And that may seem kind of strange to us because don't we pretty much do it that way every time? But remember, in most cultures, they have a larger cave or opening, especially in the cultures of this part of the world that we're talking about. And inside it would be a variety of members of the family who we place there. And after the decomposition process has taken place over a period of time and all the skin and other things like that are gone, they go back in and they collect the bones and put them in an ossuary, a bone box. And that gets filed over to the side so that there's more room in that tomb for bodies as they are put in there. So it's this constantly renewable process that goes on. This is the Garden Tomb in Jerusalem that you can go and visit. This is almost certainly not the place where Jesus was buried. But the lighting is better here from my picture than it was at another tomb, which is present in the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. This site right here, part of the reason why it's so popular, is that it's a stone's throw away from the other feature that I mentioned in class, last class period, the Golgotha, this place of a skull. I mean, you can see, if you position yourself just right, you can see both of them at the same time. Off to the left here would be the tomb, and off to the right would be the Golgotha rock formation. So that's, but it would have been something perhaps like this. This one's got a trough that you can kind of see on the bottom right here, that a stone that is circular instead of fully round would just be rolled across there for easy access. More likely, there would have been a boulder just pushed up against the thing. And that explains why the women were hoping to find somebody else to help them with that as they came to the tomb on Sunday morning. But we'll have to talk about that later because, alas, we're out of time. Thank you guys for your kind attention and your participation.